to take what you want and leave the rest, or just look for similarities and not for differences. And you may find that may be a more helpful filter to frame my chair. So I'll just quickly start, give a little brief background to the beginning. I remember right from an early age being fat, and I remember having this feeling right from childhood, like feeling fat, ugly and disgusting, and having this feeling of self-hatred and self-loathing. And I really, my mother was a compulsive overeater, so and she's also was a feeder as well, and I'm the only child. So, and my mother's a good cook of Indian food as well. So the food was the great source of comfort right from childhood. And I was really didn't really like mixing with other children. I really just liked to stay at home to eat. I was very interested in fantasy, things like fantasy films and books. Anyway, that started, and when I went from at primary school, I really loved school dinners. That was the highlight of the day, and I'd go back for seconds and thirds, which was really unusual because none of the other kids were doing it. And I would look at the other kids and think, what's wrong with the other kids? You know, I mean, why aren't they just competing with me to go back? You know, we had those English delicacies like, jam tart and custard and, rhubarb crumble. So all of those things. And I was, why wouldn't you go back again and again? So I was doing that. I was really getting into the food. How bad was it as a kid? Well, I remember going from primary school to secondary school, we had kind of like a little medical checkup. And I was so obese at that time that I was referred to what I call at that very young age a fat clinic in Finchley, where I'd go once a month and they would get these kind of metal pliers and just measure how many inches of fat I had on my skin. I'd get on the scales and they'd tape measure me up and give me these diet sheets. So right from an early age, my weight was, I was obese. There was something really, really wrong. I couldn't stop eating the food. When I got to the teens, you know, my hormones were going. I was looking at the opposite sex and just feeling really fat and ugly. My self-esteem was low. Then my mother said to me, oh, you've got bad breath. So I started losing my hair in my teens. And it was like, okay, you're fat, you're ugly, you're losing your hair and you've got bad breath. So it was really like no self-esteem as a young boy. But I remember I had this idea, you know, I should go on diets. And I won't go into a big dietologue, but I just went on diet after diet after diet, you know, and I was an extreme dieter. When I would do things, I would do them very, very extreme. And it wasn't really helpful. My father owned an Indian restaurant, which wasn't really, really helpful if you're a compulsive overeater. And I used to work there, and I used to raid the fridge after the chef had left. I'd wait for him to leave and binge out on the onion barges. You know, if I ever see him again, I'll have to make an amends to him because I used to scoff them down at the end of the day. there was that. And my father would take me to the Spitalfields catering markets to buy like boxes of apples and bananas. I'd go on these crazy diets. I was vegan for a while. My health was starting to deteriorate. You know, as I said, my hair was falling out. I got anemia. I was a vegan for a while. Had to get treatment for constipation. So really like going through these extreme diets. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I found that the illness was progressive. Year after year, things were getting worse and worse. I remember I was studying biochemistry at university, and I had a really good, one male good friend, you know, and we were both a bit nuts, so we went well together. And he said to me, oh, Sabir, why don't we get a job in the stock market? So I thought, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And I got a job in the stock market, and on the first day I was working in the Docklands, the director of the company came up to me and said, I was the equity analyst, which is the stockbroking analyst, which meant that I was writing up the reports. And he said that, oh, you have to write buy recommendations in these stocks. So I realized, that would be favorable to the company. You know, so I didn't really feel good about that, but I felt I needed the job, so I did do that. But I used my coping strategy, which I used always in life, which was at the end of a long day. I was working in the Docklands, long day of work in the Docklands. I would go to Leicester Square, where they'd have the eat as much as you want buffet restaurants in Leicester Square. This is the mid-1990s. It was the internet bubble. The brokerage was doing well. And these places, you know, they were designed for compulsive overeaters, these buffet. They were kind of dark, and you'd have a basement, and you'd walk down this dark basement, and you'd have, I call them troughs of food, which you could go back over and over again in the darkness. You can, you know. So I'd just eat and eat. And what I really, really wanted while I was eating after a long day of work was oblivion. Mm. So I would just eat and eat and eat. And I really wanted to knock myself out with the food so I just couldn't, you know, couldn't function. And I could just about get back home. I think I left those places late at night like a drunk, you know, having eaten so much food. So I could just collapse on the bed and escape. So that was going on. The company was doing well. I was promoted, and there was a prestigious flight from New York back to London. And suddenly on the flight back, my feet started to swell up. I had to take my shoes off. Came back to London. My mother was terrified when she saw the state of my feet. Had a blood test done. I was immediately admitted to the Royal Free Hospital. I had kidney failure, and I had lost about 70% of my kidney function in 24 hours. So I was literally hurtling towards death. Suddenly, it was like the doctors were rushing around, taking about 10 tubes of blood out of me at a time. And I was facing death. And I realized at the age, I was at the age of 30, and I realized as they were trying to figure out what was going wrong with me and how to halt my sudden demise, I suddenly realized that actually I wanted to live. I didn't actually want to die. And this mystical thing happened as I was facing death in the Royal Free Hospital was I surrendered. You know, this mystical thing happened. I surrendered and had a heavenly, timeless spiritual experience, a beatific heavenly experience. And I actually heard a message, find a spiritual solution. And it was so profound. And then the spiritual experience ended, but it was electrifying. And I knew I just had to find a spiritual connection somehow. I had to find God. They managed to stabilize my condition. I was released. I was released from the hospital. And my health was, you know, really, really bad. Eventually, as my kidneys deteriorated, I had to go on a dialysis machine, eight hours a day to keep me alive, walking sticks, asthma inhalers, really a wreck. But, you know, they'd saved my life. But I had to find God. But where was I going to find God? So I went to every kind of spiritual group you can imagine. I didn't know where. I would just go to, you know, I went to churches, Buddhist places, Indian gurus, all kinds of places in London. And in one of these places, I had a mentor, and he gave me a DVD. And when I watched the speaker on that DVD, I had another spiritual experience, like a tingling up the spine, where I'd never had spiritual experiences before. And I knew that this speaker was going to be very, very important for my connecting with God. And he lived in America, in Sedona. And I went out to meet him. I later found out he was one of the sponsees of a man named Bill Wilson. Now, Bill Wilson was one of the founders of the 12 Steps in AA, and wrote parts of the Big Book. And, you know, that's what got, you know, and I'd had this, and I got to meet this guy who's one of Bill's sponsees. And he was amazing. And he was the testimony of what is possible if you completely give your life to God and get this really amazing connection to God. You know, he was 40 years sober. He had 23 illnesses, many of them life-threatening. And by completely giving his life to God, all his illnesses left, and he became sober. And he was just sharing his experience, strength, and hope with other people. And that was so electrifying. You know, I came back. I went to OA. I got my sponsor... in OA, and how I got my sponsor, after these spiritual experiences, it was like I was opened up to spirit. I was having these intuitions. I never had intuitions before, like this kind of sixth sense. This all started to happen to me after my near-death spiritual experience. And I was sitting next to a man in a meeting, and he was just like an ordinary man. You know, I didn't pay him a second thought. And, you know, at the end, we say a serenity prayer, I gave him a hug. And I had this kind of inner intuition, ask him to be your sponsor. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he was absolutely the right sponsor for me. Thank you. you know, he had had, he was abstinent. He'd also, funny enough, I didn't know this, he'd had kidney failure himself and had a transplant. So anyway, God was looking after me. And, you know, I knew that, you know, the 12 steps was my pathway. It was like, I needed the 12 steps. I needed to find God. And if I didn't find God, you know, death and hell were waiting for me. Quite literally, I'd come from death and hell. Because it was, you know, I was, in the end, I was trying to essentially commit suicide with the food. So I was willing to go to any lengths. And, you know, I went through the steps in under 3 months. I gave it 100% of everything I had to go through those steps. And he said to me, Sabir, you've been through these steps in under 3 months. I think I had about two or three very mild relapses as I was going through the steps. But since that time, I've been abstinent. I'm now 10 years abstinent since working through the steps. And, you know, I haven't had body obsession for 8 years straight now. Only one day of food obsession in eight years. So essentially, for the last 8 years, I've had freedom from food and body obsession. I'm in a position of neutrality around food and body. So for the last part of the chair, I just want to share a little bit about the steps and also a little bit about having the privilege to have met one of Bill's sponsees and what I learnt from people sharing their experience, strength and hope with me. And what I learnt was, like, step one is that my life had become, I'm powerless, my life had become unmanageable. Yes. Getting kidney failure and nearly dying is quite unmanageable. And not being able to stop the food. I mean, after the kidney failure, they said you have to avoid high potassium foods because you can't regulate your potassium. As soon as they let me out, I had a bag of bananas, which is very high in potassium, and I had a blood test, and I had to have emergency treatment for a heart attack. That's how bad it was, you know. That, you know, nearly died of banana side. So it's a really serious illness. But I'm 10 years abstinent. So what happened? You know, what I learned was that, you know, in the big book it says I have a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition. But I like to use I have a daily reprieve based on how good is my connection to God on a daily basis. And what I learned from Bill Sponsee was this. There's like, you know, I've got a, you know, it's very, very simple. What I learned was very simple. It's like no connection to God. If I'm an addict and I have no connection to God, I'm going to be suicidal and I'm going to probably going to be facing death. And that's what happened to me. I had no connection to God. I was not living a moral life. I was being dishonest and I was trying to unconsciously kill myself with food And at that place, when I'm so disconnected from God and my morals and my spirit, it's like I unconsciously choose everything in a suicidal way. I ate food suicidally. I chose a career which was suicidal. I mean, you know, it was just like they're workaholic nutcases where I was working. You know, they're all, most of them are addicts. It's an insane environment. I had relationships which were suicidal. Everything I chose. So when disconnected to God, it's like I'm on a spiritual wavelength or an absence of spiritual wavelength where I'll just choose death and destruction in everything I do. If I start to get a spiritual connection to God through working a spiritual program and I get a little bit better, then my life will start to get a little bit less unmanageable. I'll probably start to get abstinent, but I'll probably have a pretty bad quality of life. I'll probably be having food obsession. I'll probably be having body obsession. Things will probably be unmanageable. I probably have bad relationships. If I work my program stronger and get a stronger connection to God, things are going to get better. My life's going to become more manageable. I'll start to have better relationships. I'll start to get better freedom from food and body obsession. And if I get a really strong connection to God, and it's only touched upon, but I felt I really learned it from someone who's really got a strong connection to God. They talk about the fourth dimension of existence. We can be catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence. And it was explained to me, you know, I can be catapulted into a realm of miracles, continuous miracles, 10 years of abstinence, essentially 8 years of freedom from food and body obsession. I'm not doing that. That's not my willpower. That's not me being clever. That's the grace of God. That's a miracle. My life is a testimony to the love and power of God. You know, by the grace of God, I'm abstinent, free of food and body. It's like, so many wonderful things have happened. It's like, you know, I have a routine. I think in the last 8 years, there's only been about 1 or 2 days where I haven't done this routine to pray, meditate, go to a meeting, do step 10s, have sponsors, have service commitments. In the last 8 years, there's only been 1 day I've not been to a meeting. You know, so every day. And why? Because it's like when I put the program first and I start to work the pray, meditate, meetings, gratitude list, step 10s, you know, and I carry the message. It's like I can feel my spiritual tank and my serenity and my peace get higher and higher. And it's like, and then the miracles happen. You know, how do I explain the fourth dimension existence? It's like you get days, thank you, you get these days like when all the buses arrive on time, all the tubes arrive on time. You know, I had a terrible relationship with my mother, but, you know, I had made amends to my mother. She died about a year ago. I was able to be there as she was dying and tell her that I loved her. She told me that she loved me. All of these miracles come. And it's like when you get a strong, you know, when I work every aspect of this program, I remember, you know, when I started the program, I'm still so enthusiastic. You know, I got my first sponsee, and it's like every sponsee I got, like a miracle happened in my life. It's like God saying, well done. I'll open up an area of your life. And I had my second sponsee. I had my third sponsee. I remember I was on 7 sponsees and someone asked me to be their sponsor. And I said, yes. And, you know, and then I was on a dialysis machine 8 hours a day to keep me alive. I said yes to this person. And within 2 days, I got a phone call from the Royal Free with a transplant. And I got a kidney transplant. It's like, as I helped others and gave service, it was like God was giving me life, you know. And, you know, people say to me things like, well, how can you be in meetings every day? I mean, how is that possible? And I found, like, you know, things like if I put my faith in putting the program first, I found that, you know, and I always would try and get work that would fit around my program, never put work, relationships or anything before my routine. And I found when I had that attitude, you know, to find jobs around meetings so I didn't miss my program routine, it was like, I always found jobs, and then it was like I was getting more and more money and having to do less and less time at work. And I now, you know, my financial situation, I'd be bragging if I tell you how much money I've got in my bank. It's like the more I do God's work, the richer I get, the more free time I get. It's like all, it's like a miraculous power starts to look after you when I put the program. And I'll start to end on this. I know I'm a bit over time. For me, this is a program of faith. You know, it's the faith to put the program first, to do those spiritual acts, pray, meditate, do meetings, do step work, give service. And, you know, my life was extremely manageable to the point where I was nearly dead. And I'm totally alive, full of health. My financial situation's good. I have capacity to be present. I have great relationships. But by putting, you know, as an addict, when life is unmanageable, when I have problems, for me, the solution is still to put the program first. And if I get big problems, I do even more meetings and even more service. You know, as an addict, it would be like my usual default thing is problems. If I've got problems, I need to fix the problems. Now, if I have problems, I need to do more meetings and get more spiritual connection and let God handle the problems. So very, very grateful for this. But it's all this thing. You know, for me, it's a program of ego deflation. You know, more that I work this program, my ego gets slower and God comes in, the Son out of the Spirit comes in. And it's like, I don't want, you know, I've always wanted a lazy life. I don't want to take care of myself. I was hoping someone, and I found that the greatest carer is God. You know, when I work this program, God takes care of me. And I'm so grateful. Thank you for letting me share today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.